My absolutely amazing guest today is Joe Jacoby. Joe is the former CEO of USA Canoe Kayak. He is an Olympic gold medalist. I believe, Joe, you're the first Olympic gold medalist in canoe kayak area, right? So I want to get this right. I know you won a gold medal, correct?
That's correct. My canoe partner, Scott Strassball, and I were the first Americans to win an Olympic gold medal in the sport of whitewater canoe slalom. And incredibly, I never thought I'd be saying this in the year 2019, but maybe this will change next year. We're still the only Americans ever to have won a gold medal in the Olympics for the United States in this in whitewater canoe slalom. So hopefully that'll change soon, though. Hopefully that'll change.
Coming on Culture Matters, because you are a fascinating guy. Now, you write a column, Sunday Morning Joe, that I think is one of the most thoughtful and kind of authentic, real columns that's out there written by a leader. So what's the idea behind Sunday Morning Joe?
Yeah, I mean, the really kind of frightening part of it was this is sort of Joe's journey of kind of exploring his vulnerabilities. And, I think that, I came from a sports world and from the top of a sports world where, people kind of see the best attributes in champions and they don't always see the inside thoughts and they don't see the inside feelings. And then I think that kind of almost doubles down when you're the chief executive officer of one of these Olympic sport organizations. There's a lot, it seems, that goes into the appearances and that you've got things under control. And, I think there's a lot of people who work in this industry who are hurting in some way, shape, or form. Relationships, their health, they're feeling stuck in what they do, even though it kind of looks like they have it all. And when I kind of work very slowly to start to get healthy and eventually get healthy enough to where I saw that there was another way forward in my life besides working inside of the Olympic movement, particularly during, one of the, the United States Olympic Committee's darkest hours, in their organization's history. I mean, it really, really dark time, as an organization for the United States Olympic Committee. And, I think once I left, I just kind of mustered up the courage just to start exploring my own vulnerabilities and my own creativity. And out of that came Sunday Morning Joe, which is a weekly post that I write about, the pursuing our purpose, overcoming challenge, and, finding just really our small steps forward every day in the world, that just, those really small wins and those our softer sides, our inner voices, and how we kind of quiet the noise so that we can hear those inner voices better. That's what Sunday Morning Joe is all about. I write it for myself, but it sure seems that every Sunday, a lot of people seem to be getting something positive out of it. So that makes me feel really good too.
Well, it's incredibly thoughtful. If I'm listening to this interview and I'm coming on to Culture Matters, and you mentioned the USOC, right?
Yeah.
Which for anybody who doesn't know, United States Olympic Committee. And you mentioned dark days.
Yes.
To what are you referring?
Well, most of all, we're kind of looking at just, hundreds of young women that were sexually abused, by, that's just gymnastics by, by one person on their support team who's now, in prison. But what I mean by the dark days is that I think it's becoming more and more clear that more people knew about these issues and didn't act on these issues very timely, which is, this isn't even about talking about right or wrong. This is just, it's just almost like inhumane in so many ways. And I now can sort of look at that. I still don't feel like many of these athletes who have these brave and courageous athletes who have come forward to tell their stories, have been still to this day appropriately acknowledged. And I think it's like all of us have heard them except for the people who matter most.
Right.
Who have the power to kind of to really change this organization. And, you know, look, I should say that, you know, this is sort of a just a the Olympic movement has a lot of good qualities to it, a lot of good values for which it was based. But it also historically, not just the United States, but the International Olympic Committee has really dark moments that have just never been very well corrected or very well acknowledged, and just kind of really bad black marks. So you can go back, you know, to the World War II period and kind of look at who was serving on the International Olympic Committee. I mean, just horrible people, and were, you know, who had, you know, very limited and racist views on the world. And it's very hard to kind of make the changes, you know, as a person, as a team, as an organization, when you can't go back, when you won't go back and kind of at least acknowledge your history and where mistakes were made. I think that we get ourselves into a lot of trouble. And I'm not suggesting that, you know, I'm not a history revisionist, but to not acknowledge, you know, some of these mistakes that have been made historically, it just creates the culture for making more mistakes not to be acknowledged in the future.
So the cultural dysfunction within that movement, right? Mm-hmm. Whether it's the U.S. movement or the international movement, is it, in your opinion, is it endemic at this point? Is it systemic? Would it take a complete transformation to change it? Because at least I'm not hearing from you, that you feel like there's any real transformation that's taken place, even in light of Dr. Nasar going to jail for the rest of his life and in light of all of these young women being abused. Because it probably wasn't just in gymnastics. It's probably in
It is. I mean, that's been documented and shown. I just sort of use that, you know, as an example. I think it's an it's an important example, because I think the most memorable athletes, you know, to the American public, you know, that have come out, you know, were, you know, really high level gymnasts whose names and faces we knew and were aware of. And so I think it is, it's important. They're a good reference point, but no, you're correct. There are many, many more. And the Olympic movement is really good at kind of putting out big words, but it often falls short on actions. I don't want to make this sound, I don't want anyone who's listening to this to think that, like, I obsess about this issue a lot. I've made a lot of peace with it, and I really, really admire the champions who are stepping up to try to create the change. Like your Nancy Hogsheads of the world from Champion Women, who are just, I mean, they're laying themselves out there in a huge way to really to facilitate the kind of change that I think Olympic sport needs. And I think there's a lot of good people doing good things in this. We recognize that. And I think that even the Team USA athletes who are representing the United States in international competition, you know, deserve an opportunity to have a good and positive Olympic experience, because if they do, they can become a part of a more positive element of change as well. But yeah, I don't really believe, it's in my heart, that you can kind of leave it to the people who had some degree of kind of helping the U.S. Olympic Committee get to the state, also kind of be a part of fixing it as well. I think that there really needs to be a sincere effort that comes from far outside of Colorado Springs to, you know, to create a movement that we can start to feel good about and begin to build trust again, and one that will put the word, you know, respect, you know, and not just but really encourage respect from all the different places. I mean, it's like, I think the Olympics is such an honor to be a part of, whether it's as an athlete or a coach or a chief executive officer or a board member or a team doctor, like, it really shouldn't be a three strikes and you're out kind of thing. It's like one, you know, it's just, it's that kind of honor. And it's just, it's like, if you can't get behind that part of it, like, what are you doing here in the first place?
You mentioned the values now, because your vantage point is it's very valuable.
Yeah.
It is. You're a gold medalist.
It can be. Yeah.
Gold medalist. You've been the CEO of a major division of Olympic sport. Right.
Yes.
So your vantage point is quite unique. There aren't a lot of people in the world who have your vantage point. Right. Yeah. So trust is broken in a culture, right, then how is that trust regained? I have several other questions for you on this, but I'm just curious as to, because I think that people are interested in this, you know, maybe not, well, you know, when this right, thing broke a couple of years ago, right, this was huge well, international news, right?
I think to carry this sort of a little bit, you know, outside of this conversation, anytime that we lose trust in something, I think the parts deep inside of us that are really kind of paying attention are not to the words, but to the actions, right? I mean, this is leadership 101.
Right.
People just have this gauge that exists deep inside of them that's constantly talking to them, and they're kind of looking at leadership, whether it's in business, whether it's in sport, whether it's in politics or communities or church, they just have something that's kind of ticking inside of them that is just kind of signaling. It's like a gauge that's kind of signaling the consistency with people's words and their actions. And I just feel like, boy, this just kind of feels like a chapter that just never wants to end. Mm. And again, that's why I kind of commend the people who have kind of really put in the time to just, they just won't sleep. My life has moved on in ways right. where, like, I found a way to do a little bit of coaching in the sport of canoeing that is as grassroots as you can get. I mean, as we're talking,
you're there right now, like you're in Spain.
Well, I'm looking over the top of my computer right now, right onto the Olympic on the 1992 Olympic Canoeing Channel, and watching the Spanish national canoe team prepare for the World Championships, which are going to be held here in a few weeks.
Cool.
And it gives me, like, that's kind of all I need at this stage is I coach canoeing as just a kind of a passion project, as a volunteer. And I guess the one thing I try to do before I leave my house that overlooks the Olympic Channel every morning to go to the practice session is not what color medal I'm trying to help the athlete win, or what team I'm trying to help the athlete qualify for. I'm just kind of thinking, like, what might be the effect of my time, my collaboration with this athlete 20 years from now, when this athlete is a parent, when they're in a professional role, far from the sport of canoeing, what might kind of transpire today during the practice session that actually might make their life better and just have a positive influence. And I think about that every day before I leave the house. And so I kind of left my guard. I left my position as sort of, you know, that standing guard position a long time ago. Like, my war ended with this like a long time ago. And I hope for the best. And I really admire the people that are trying to create, you know, the change. And that's my perspective on it. And, you know, people are, you know, there are people who ran national governing bodies during this dark time of the U.S. Olympic Committee that benefited, whose organizations got better and stronger during that time. Mine was not. My organization, USA Canoe Kayak, was absolutely cut off at the knees by the United States Olympic Committee during this dark hour. But my cynicism is not about that. I mean, it was, I think, related to the darkness that was happening in Colorado Springs. My cynicism is just geared towards, how do you have hundreds of, you know, young women that were children that were just being abused, and, you know, you didn't act on it, you know, like, immediately.
Right.
I just don't count. I just that just doesn't, it just doesn't compute for me.
One of the things that we are teaching like day after day, right, is that you can't policy culture. People create culture, right? And if people within an organization, if the people within an organization are culturally unhealthy or unskilled, then you're going to have a culturally unhealthy organization. Doesn't matter how much policy you lay down, right? Right. And the reality is what creates dark days are dark people.
Yeah.
You know, and you just have people in leadership within that organization who either turned a blind eye knowingly, right? Which just means they were extremely culturally unhealthy and just unhealthy individuals themselves, that they would permit a culture like that to be propagated or to be even be allowed, right?
I think that's, I mean, I think what you just said, I mean, that's the whole thing about leadership. I mean, leadership is a big buzzword. Leadership development, leadership training, like these are big buzzwords in our respective fields, Ricardo. And people want to lead people and build teams. And that's kind of the punchline to all this, is that it's about your own health. It's about your own disposition. It's about your willingness to work on yourself day after day after day, growing, evolving, changing, learning, and just never stopping to do that in a very actionable way. And when you know, when you don't, you're kind of done. And you know, if you're not healthy, if you don't have that health, the idea that you're going to be a great leader or lead healthy teams is just it doesn't add up. It doesn't compute.
Right.
So that's just kind of this, you know, this is just sort of ringing the bell for that call to action to, you know, to sort of pull our health together.
So you're living in Spain, right?
And living in the Spanish state of Catalonia.
Okay. And
yes.
And you've been there how long?
Been living here for 2 years this week. And prior to that, I started to come to La Seu d'Urgell, which is the city where we live. About 2 hours north of Barcelona. I started coming here in 1991 as an athlete, as a canoeing athlete, preparing for the 1992 Olympic Games. So the town I live in is where my canoe partner, Scott Strassbaugh, and I won the Olympic Games.
Oh, my. So that's amazing. So I'm interested in some of the lessons, the cultural lessons you've learned on two fronts, right?
Yes.
One is, what have you learned about the Spaniards, you know, especially in the zone, that in the region that you're in, right? Because maybe, you know, there is diversity within Spain, right? And so
my answer to that is going to get exactly into that. So
what have you learned about the Spaniards that I think that you think would be interesting or important for people listening in who may be planning a trip to Spain sometime? And then also just on your personal journey, from a cultural standpoint, how has this transition from the United States to a foreign country been for you? And what are some of the lessons that you've learned as it relates to cultural adaptation and just learning to live successfully within another culture?
So first of all, I think the part of your three questions that kind of resonate with me the most is the Spanish part. I mean, it's just, and for me, there's a delineation. I think if you were interviewing someone from Texas, like, Texans are so proud of Texas, right? Like, and I love it. I love their pride. I'm not from Texas, but I'm like envious of the pride that people from Texas have of their home state. And they just like delineate it. Like, they don't need to say they're from the United States. It's like, oh, I'm Texas. They can say that anywhere in the world. And it's like, people, you know, get that. And I'm like, yeah, that's pretty cool. So Catalonia is a Spanish state, and look, Catalonia feels very different than just, I know we're a part of this bigger thing called Spain. And I think on an athletic level, I have a better appreciation for what like Spain means to me when you ask, you know, it's these athletes from Galicia and from Segovia and Murcia and the Basque region and the Catalans coming together to kind of represent this great country. And it is a great country and worth seeing, but culturally speaking, it's not Spanish here. It's very Catalan. And where I live in La Seu d'Urgell, which is a Catalan town of 12,000 people, people can speak Spanish. This is a great story. When I first came here, I started to speak Spanish. And people were helpful, but they would probably prefer to speak English and just learn that. And they certainly weren't like very patient or accommodating with my Spanish. However, when I started to learn Catalan, oh my gosh, people are so patient and they're so kind. Like they get so excited that like an American is learning and speaking Catalan. And look, it's more practical in many ways to speak Spanish. I could travel and use the Spanish more. Catalan, it's a beautiful language. It's a beautiful culture and a beautiful people. And the reason I choose Catalan is that, sure, if I go have a cup of coffee with my Catalan friends, they could speak Spanish or English with me, but when they speak to each other, they're going to speak Catalan. So if I want to be a part of that conversation, which that's what matters to me in building friendships and kind of learning about a culture, is to really not have them speak differently to me, but for me to be a part of that circle. Catalan was the answer for that. And in learning Catalan, it was, I should share one more sort of story, because you might have some interesting insights about the story I'm about to share with you. So we have what's called this like lost generation of Catalan. So when Franco was running, had control of Spain, Ricardo, Catalans were not permitted to speak Catalan. And in school and in jobs, they all spoke Spanish. And so, you know, I remember when I was really small going to elementary school in the United States. And I remember when I first learned the words like go and red and dog and those words. And you remember that joy that you felt when you like learned to read in your native language.
Yeah.
It was really special.
It was like a see spot run.
Yes. You felt proud. And I just sort of remind people, and I remind the Catalan children of this today, because I get invited to go speak to the English classes at the Catalan schools here. I say, guys, some of your parents and definitely your grandparents, they didn't get that joy of learning their native language, how to read and how to write in their native language. They learned another language. And they would speak it at home, you know, around dinner tables and things like that. But when they were in town, they spoke Spanish. And now I just think it's important, you know, to remind children like how fortunate they are to get to be able to learn Catalan and what that means, knowing that like their immediate family didn't have that that opportunity. If their parents were older than me, you know, it was Spanish, not Catalan.
Yeah,
and I don't mean to make it sound like it's the worst hardship in the world, but now that I look back at the United States and conversations about languages and kind of where things are sort of shifting and trending in the United States, being here in Catalonia and understanding that there's a generation of people that didn't learn to read or write in their native language, I'm sensitive to that. It's a special, special joy and privilege that I had to be able to learn to do that in English. And I'm very grateful that Catalan children today have that opportunity, which their parents and grandparents did not have.
It's a fascinating point, because a couple things kind of come to my thinking as you're talking, and that is just the importance of to really get to know people. You get to know people in their language, because that's where their heart language is, right?
Yeah.
So that you maybe someone, like for me, Spanish was actually my first language. And so if somebody really, really wants to dig deep into my soul, they probably can do so more effectively in Spanish than in English. It's just part of the soul, right? And so there's that heart language. The other thing that really strikes me, Joe, is, and you're just really just bringing it to light, you know, like culture has five primary elements.
Hmm.
One of those elements is language. And when you gut the language out of a people, you gut their culture, right? You take away a very essential element of who they are as a people. And so the movement sometime, I think, to take away native language is a very dangerous movement, because it's taking away culture and it fundamentally changes people. And so it's I think sometimes people don't understand They think that language is just a means of communication, but language is part of the culture and soul of a people. It's how they express themselves. It's how they feel. And so what you're saying is just kind of underscoring that for me, you know, and it's, and you know that I have done quite a bit of work in the language field and actually have Spanish courses. I have English refinement courses for Latinos in through Bilingual America. So it's for something that I'm very, I think it's an integral part to cultural communications. So when you made the transition from the U.S. to Spain, I know you've traveled internationally. What are some lessons in your international travels or in your transition to Spain that you would say to people, you know, this doing these things really helped me to adapt to a new culture more quickly? Just some words of advice and wisdom.
Yeah, so I'm going to take you and our listeners back to 1991. I was I was 20 years old. I came to Liceo d'Urgell for the first time to start training for the Olympic Games. And Ricardo, I had an epiphany, and I was not like this bright, enlightened 20-year-old. I was the opposite. I was tired. I was living out of a duffel bag, and we were going from international race to international race. And finally we get to this practice competition to test out the Olympic venue. It was my first time here. And I remember my bag hit the floor and duffel bag that I dropped on the floor of the hotel room. And when the bag hit the floor, I just had this epiphany. Like everywhere I go, I live out of a duffel bag. And let's live place to place to place to place, because every Sunday night a race would end. Monday we would travel to the next place and we would go live there for a week and then repeat this process week after week all summer long. But this was different when I got to Liceo. I dropped the bag on the floor and I had this epiphany that a year later, when I woke up in the Olympic Village on the morning of our Olympic race, I did not want to feel like an American visitor in the Olympic Village in Liceo d'Urgell. I wanted to feel like I had a sense of belonging here. And after that, instead of leaving all my dirty clothes in the duffel bag, I started to put my clothes in the drawers and in the closet and like kind of move in, so to speak. And then when I went into town and to go to the supermarket or have a coffee or to have a meal, the transactions, you know, the relationships with people, it wasn't just transactional. Like I thought of these people as my neighbors now, as people like I could have a relationship with. And what's amazing is that some of these people I met in July of 1991 are still my friends today here in Liceo. They're, you know, a couple of them work over at the Hotel Nice, just a couple blocks from my house here. And they still work there all these years later, almost 30 years later. And it was that ability to just kind of not just go out and practice on the water every day, but to just, if you think about what it takes to connect and get a sense of belonging, you have to have respect for the spirit and the respect for the culture of the people and take an interest in what they're doing and how they see things and how they do things. And I just started to do that moment by moment, and I liked it more and more and more. Then on the day of the Olympic race, like I accomplished that goal when I opened my eyes on August from my sleep on, you know, waking up on the 2nd of August, 1992, going down to the Olympic venue and winning a gold medal in this town, that just took everything I had done culturally speaking for the previous year and just multiplied it times 10,000. Wow. Like I went from having this beautiful relationship to having this beautiful relationship that also was a major part of actually winning, you know, the biggest sporting event, you know, of my life. And that just kind of changed that moment when in 1991, when I just kind of had this epiphany about having a sense of belonging in the community, not just being a good athlete and paddling the canoe fast. That was the change for me. And it's like, I don't understand why anyone can't take what I did in a really small way, anytime they travel anywhere, not just to another country, but to another part of the United States.
Right.
You know, if you live in Northern California and you make a trip down to Huntsville, Alabama, why can't you have that same disposition when you travel someplace like that. You know, you come from a sense of what does the experience look like when I sort of desire like a sense of belonging here?
Mm.
People will read you differently when you do that, because you're coming with humility and respect, and not like, well, this isn't how we do it in Silicon Valley. That's where I think, you know, we see change happen, both personally, professionally, you know, athletically, you name it, you know, that's where we see change.
That's beautiful, man.
I can tell you how it is now. I am, you know, I am received really, really well here. And, you know, I think people see efforts to learn the language, to understand the history, to kind of stand with people shoulder to shoulder in this community, around community issues, around supporting artists and athletes and local business, all the things that sort of good, healthy communities do. Like, we're a part of that. And you know, I like just that sense of learning every day. Like, that's what makes it so good and compelling, is that I think in me or my family, that the local people in this community see, you know, Americans really striving to put their best foot forward on behalf of La Seu d'Urgell, this community, the Catalan people, and to that end, we know that a strong La Seu d'Urgell, a strong Catalonia, that benefits this country as well. You know, that we know that.
You know, your spirit is so refreshing, man, and I really appreciate that, because it's like, you know, if you talk about wanting to know, wanting to understand, you know, it's like stage one in cultural mastery is education. You know, and I always tell people, yeah, if you're not curious, you don't care.
Yes.
Right. And I've met so many people, they've been around people from different countries and they know so little about them, and they're just not curious. Right. And what I'm hearing from you is this, that not only that sense of humility, that spirit, but also a spirit, like a proactive spirit of, hey, I really want to understand you. I want to know your history. I want to know your culture. I want to know who you really are. Not maybe what I want to think about you, but the reality of who you are. And I think if all of us had that spirit, it'd go a long ways in healing some of our cultural dysfunction, for sure. So
yeah, being here helps me gain a perspective on, you know, on how that transpires in the U.S. My final story for you, Ricardo. It's I think it's a pretty interesting one. Catalonia's national day is the 11th of September. And last year on the 11th of September, I went down to Barcelona with, and stood on the largest avenue in Barcelona with, more than a million other Catalans who, you know, who seek a certain kind of freedom in their lives. And many of them, I mean, the organization it takes to assemble a million Catalans, and they do this at least once a year. I mean, it happens so infrequently in the United States, a country that is so many more people. And, you know, I think, you know, you can count the number of times a million people or more have gotten together, you know, in the last 10 years on one hand in the United States. And it's an annual occurrence here in Catalonia. And what's interesting to me is that as I talk to people at the Diada, the national day, and the, you know, these people from all over the region seeking, you know, a certain level of freedom that they don't believe they have, what I see is that when people assemble and come together and actually take action like that, it's like, oh my gosh, do you realize how much we don't do this in the United States? You don't believe you're free, and I see this freedom, these free people. And then in the United States, I see people talking about freedom all the time, but not really acting as if they are free. Yeah, it is interesting. And I think that's a big takeaway for me. And so I think regardless of the political position, view, or your what you think is possible, I have a lot more respect for, you know, how people assemble and come together to, you know, to create change and make a movement. I think it's just like, that is just this greatest level of freedom. And I see it with the Catalans. It's like, oh my gosh, you don't realize how free you really are. It's just a beautiful freedom that you're exercising and the organization it takes to get a million people together on the streets of Barcelona, it does not happen easily. And the efforts that people go to make that happen, it's a beautiful human event.
Every time I talk with you, I not only am I inspired, I'm just enthralled, you know, because you're just an interesting guy.
We need you to come here. We need you to come.
I would love to go there, man. I really enjoy talking with you. Every time we talk, I love it, right? So my guest today has been the very distinguished Joe Jacoby. I would encourage you to check out Joe's Sunday Morning Joe.
Yes.
You know, I think it's a great read. Not a long read, and it's not an academic read, but it's a real read, right? And so I'd encourage the listeners to check out Joe's Sunday Morning Joe. I think it's worth the read. And Joe, your perspective is enlightening, and it's very helpful. So thank you so much for coming on Culture Matters. And we'll talk again soon, I'm sure.
Thank you. Thank you for all the work you are doing and your service to bringing cultures together and just helping improve the way people live. It's super honorable what you're doing and the way you've organized the values and the mission of cultural mastery. Very cool stuff, my friend.
Well, thank you, my brother.